And now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak, and he taught them, saying, and we'll come back to that. The crowds are there, the mountain is there, and the disciples are those from the crowd who come to Jesus and listen to his words. Anyone can come. Those who don't come remain the crowd. Those who do are the disciples, to actually personally listen to him. And that's quite dramatic. And that's where it's now in the setting of the Sermon on the Mount. The crowds appear in the very last verse of the sermon, chapter 7, verse 28 to 29. At the end of the sermon, we come back to that. When Jesus had finished saying these things, which we'll look at later, the crowds were astounded at his teaching, and he taught them as one having authority, not as their scribes. So clearly Matthew wants us to understand the teaching that comes is there for everybody, for the crowds. And the crowds are astonished by it. So he doesn't let us forget that this is not a little coterie of people listening here. It's for the world. In fact, it's for everybody. However, there is a special group that are coming close to him to really listen, heed, and follow him. And they're the ones we call disciples. And this particular sermon, the first of the five large sermons, no doubt based on the Pentateuch, the five scrolls of the law, in this new law, the first one is about, okay, what does it mean to be a disciple? And that's what we'll start looking at in a moment. The mountain that we're looking at is Mount Sinai. I mean, it is the Mount of Beatitudes, which is a hill or something, presumably. But this is symbolic language here. We're meant to imagine Moses on the mountain of Sinai, receiving the law and bringing the law down to the crowds on the two tablets of stone. Jesus is on the mountain, the new Moses, bringing the new Torah to the whole world. The quotation from Exodus, the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain. Wait there and I'll give you the tablets of stone, with the law and the commandment which I've written for their instruction." Isaiah chapter 57, is it how beautiful on the mountain are the feet of those who bring the good news, who say your God reigns. Here is Jesus bringing good news on the mountain to the whole world, and we've got to pray at the beginning of it that we're willing to listen and learn and want to be what Jesus is telling us we are to be. And for the rest of this first meditation, we'll be reflecting on the Beatitudes. So these are Jesus' words. I'll just read them through simply and then start going through them slowly with you. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And before we move on, let's look at the word blessed, because it comes in every one of these. Blessed is the English, of course. The Greek is a makarios, and I only say that because makarios is a very common Greek name still. And a lot of the Greek patriarchs are makarios. You'll often hear it as a name. And it comes from the Hebrew, the original Hebrew expression is of no value particularly, I'll just say it, is ashrei, and it often appears in the Psalms and the Old Testament in Beatitudes. Blessed is the one whose hands are free of guilt. Ashrei, Greek makarios. So it's a common enough expression. What it means is really important. It's sometimes translated happy. Happy are the poor in spirit. You've no doubt heard that. That's pretty good, really. But the problem with the word happy is that it doesn't contain in it the basis for any happiness. And the word itself, if we're going to be really strict in language, happy, H-A-P-P-Y, I say that not because I don't think you can spell, but because it's the same root as happen, H-A-P-P-E-N, or haphazard, hap. Something that happens to be there by chance, by luck, by fortune. So when you're happy, a lot of that's luck. What did you eat for tea tonight? Could affect your happiness. Someone's letter that they happened to write to you today. Or just the vagaries of moods and male hormones. I suppose women have them too, do you? So you've got happiness is really not a deep word. It's a beautiful thing to be happy, but it's chancy. This is not about that. The word blessed is good, but it doesn't quite capture what the word means. Blessed means blessed by God, which gets us to the source. It's something that God does in blessing us with grace. So blessed is a bliss, B-L-I-S-S, it's the same word as blessed. So it's a bliss thing, it's coming from God. That's good, but if we had an English word, I'd give it to you, but we haven't got it. What the ashrei or makarios means is joyful, but in a joy that you could have on a cross, like Jesus. So we're not talking about happiness. A joy that's really profound, that is a gift from God, and is known to be a blessing. The joy of doing God's will. The joy of being in communion with God. The joy of faith, of trust, even in terrible circumstances. So that's what we're talking about here. If you like, a happiness that comes from being blessed and allowing the blessing to permeate your being. Well, who are blessed? Who have this bliss? Who experience this profound but faith experience of joy? Who does it? Well, here's the list. And I want you to notice the first and last ones stand out. They are really the key ones, and I'm going to do them first, actually. The first and the eighth. Then there are six in the middle, which have a different focus, and they are really subdivisions of the first. The last or eighth one is a qualification of it. So I want to look with you at the first and last one, which are in the present tense, and I'll just read them as they are. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Is the kingdom. Now, present tense. The kingdom of heaven is at hand, he said a moment ago. Here it is for those who are blessed and accept the blessing, namely, the poor in spirit. That's our key concept. Look at the last one, verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, because they're doing what's right. Not for other reasons, but precisely because of that, because they're doing God's will. They are persecuted. Blessed are you, are those, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Same phrase. So I want to look with you now at who are the poor in spirit and why is this qualified by those persecuted for righteousness' sake or because of righteousness. And then we'll come back to the middle Beatitudes, which you'll see are all in the future. The promise is in the future. Firstly, the poor in spirit. And this is the key concept of being a disciple. If we could get this right, everything follows. It's the most profound concept and probably the most subtle, probably the one that's closest to sanctity and probably the one that we're slowest to get, I don't know. Poor in spirit. Spirit always in the Bible, whenever you read spirit, immediately think of your contact with God. Because Spirit means the thing that you haven't got, but receive and give. You've got a body, you've got blood, you've got bones, you've got all that. But spirit is breath, and you don't have breath. You either breathe it in, and then you've got some, but immediately you've got to give it back again, haven't you? And that's sometimes hard if you can't get it, if you're asthmatic. So breath is not anything you can hold. You just have to be ready to receive it and give it. And the breath is God's breath. God made Adam, formed him out of the clay, as the story goes. Then God breathed into his nostrils the breath, the spirit of life. And Adam became a living being, living now with God's breath. But as soon as he breathes it back, what's going to happen if God doesn't keep breathing again? The breath is a kiss. It's a love gift. So God breathes breath into you. And if he didn't breathe it into you in a couple of minutes' time, you would die. Take away your breath, says the psalm, and we fade into nothing. So every time you breathe in, you should be really delighted because God is loving you and breathing life into you. For no bad reason. I mean, for every good reason. That's the spirit. To be poor in spirit means poor in relation to God. Okay, so let's define it more closely. If we take our word poor in ordinary language, I think we could define it as a person is poor who does not have the resources to meet their own needs. So if you've got three children and you haven't got any food to give them, you're poor because you need food and you haven't got it. If you have no shelter over you, if you have no peace in your home because you're in a war situation and you can't guarantee the security of those you love, you're poor. If you haven't got enough money to buy food in a city situation where you haven't got your own garden, you're poor, and so on. So a person is poor who hasn't got the resources to meet his or her own needs. And there are many indices of poverty, of course. I've just mentioned some and you could fill your mind up with plenty of others. But I think it's true that our greatest need, and how do you talk about this carefully, but surely our greatest need is for love. We need food, we need clothing, we need shelter. But more than anything, we human beings need love because we're made for it. And given a choice of dying, therefore not having health, but having love around you while you die, or having good health and no love, I don't know, it's good to have both, isn't it? But I think from the people I've seen dying with love around them, I think love seems to be the key to our lives. So we need love, and if we could accept that at least as a for a moment, lacking love is our greatest poverty. So the poor are those who recognize their need for love, but who know they have it from God. The poor in spirit are those who know they can't do it on their own, know they're not self-reliant, know they can't hold their breath, their spirit, know they can't build up their own life and own world, but have to receive it constantly from God. Recognize this and in their distress cry out to God. Like the poor in Egypt. Exodus chapter 3. The Lord said, I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cry. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians. The Old Testament often defines God as the one who hears the cry of the poor. The poor are those who cry. Know they need and reach up to God and ask for what they need. Trustingly. Jesus is saying here, if you are really poor, meaning You know you haven't got the resources to build your own life. And you are crying out to God for the grace and the blessing for to find meaning and healing and love. You are blessed, says Jesus, because that's exactly what Jesus' mission is. God is answering your prayer now in Jesus. Yours is the kingdom of heaven. God is going to reign in your hearts. Mary of Magdala, thief on the cross, leper, run through the whole gospel, or any of us if we wish. We are blessed. Jesus said, talking about the poor in spirit, unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. It's there for you, but you can't even enter it. Because only the poor can enter it. Only the one poor in spirit can enter. Our pride and our self-reliance is a barrier to grace. We're like little children who are kicking and punching and want to get going, and we won't be held. In fact, I'll just put on there for you in a moment, or now, the beautiful psalm that I think best sums this up. It's Psalm 131. This translation I'm offering you now is, there are many new translations. This is from the International Liturgical Commission. It was only produced this year. I'm not quite sure how good it is yet. I don't know my own opinion on it is what I mean. Because the Grail have also got out one, and I think it's better. But anyhow, here it is for what it's worth. It reads, Lord, I am not proud, holding my head too high, reaching beyond my grasp. No, I am calm and tranquil. Or as the Septuagint says, calm and humble. Calm and tranquil, like a weaned child resting in its mother's arms. My whole being is at rest. That's the perfect, I think, image of the poor in spirit. And so you mums and dads know exactly what that feels like from your point of view or the child's point of view. To be the poor in spirit is a child resting in the mother's arms or the father's arms, at peace, knowing it's totally dependent on the parent, but very happy because the one on whom it depends is there loving it. So it's there. I don't think there's a finer image for the essential nature of Christian life than that. So that's the poor in spirit. Well, he goes on to say, blessed are those persecuted for righteousness' sake. This is the last beatitude. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I think what Matthew's doing there, no doubt based on what Jesus said, is that, okay, it's all right for a baby in the mother's arms to be a baby in the mother's arms. I mean, it's kind of natural. How do you become a little child as an adult? And I'm not the first to ask that question. Do you remember Nicodemus in John's Gospel? Chapter 3 comes to Jesus by night and says, how will I enter this mystery? And Jesus said, you'll have to be born again. He said, but I can't go back into my mother's womb. And Jesus said, no, I didn't mean that. You have to become a child again. You'll have to receive from the Spirit. A lovely image, by the way, of the Spirit as mother in John's Gospel. Go back to your mother's womb. It's the womb of the Spirit. It's a new birth, a new creation here. So that's hard for an adult to do, as you know. We have this natural, I think you might say, God-given tendency to become self-resourceful, and that's healthy. And we have to be that way in our youth and our young manhood or womanhood. I guess that's important. But there comes a kind of a time for all of us, later or earlier, depending on don't know what, when we have to learn to let go. We can't do what we used to be able to do. Eventually we have to let go our life in dying. But every day is a dying for all of us. And that letting go, it starts to dawn on us. We've got this natural longing for God, but we don't have in us a natural longing to be dependent, I don't think. It's not there. So it's a struggle thing, a difficult thing to become a little child again, to be humble, to accept to be dependent. Our ego has to withdraw and gradually be loved away till we are happy to be an instrument of God and to let God love and live through us. I live no longer I, says Paul, but Christ lives in me. His ego's gone. Remember, I read about 2 months ago the life of, don't ask me how or when I did it, but I did, the life of John the 23rd by Peter Hebblethwaite. That was my biggest impression of John the 23rd when in his 70-year-old maturity, was that he had no ego left. Like, he set up the council, as you remember, and that's a big thing to do, and it was his dream, you might say, and it was a prayer dream. And then he set up this special secretariat for Christian unity alongside of and outside of the Roman Curia, which was a very smart move, because the Roman Curia were professional theologians that were pretty fixed in their ways, no doubt, and no doubt their ways were good and they'd worked, but they weren't, change wasn't going to blow through there too quickly. So he had this second group that didn't belong to them set up outside them, submissive to them, all that, yes, but with a bursting energy of ecumenism and all that going for them. So that's one thing he did. But then when the Curia produced all these documents for the council, you might know the story, they went to the Pope before they went to the council, and the Pope went through them and ticked them and signed them and made a few little changes. He was very happy with the documents. Then they went to the council and they all got thrown out the window. All of them. Well, you know, if you dreamed this thing up for years and really wanted it, can you imagine yourself fighting to keep them? I mean, a bit. John the 23rd, no. Because he trusted the community, he trusted the Spirit. The Spirit breathed through him to ask the council, but he knew the Spirit was breathing through all the bishops, so he was quite able to say, let's see what happens. Thank God he was like that, but he was. And that's the big thing. It must be hard to be a parent and do that with your teenage kids, or to be anybody and do that. To be willing to let your own preferences and even your own spiritual insights have no more force than what they're worth. And you don't push or control in that sense. Well, I think I'm trying to say something about the last of the blessed are those who are persecuted. Because to become a little child as an adult in a hard world where not everyone's like your mother loving you, is hard, because how do you remain vulnerable in a world that hurts you? How do you remain giving when people don't accept what you give or throw it back at your face? How do you remain loving when people are not loving you? How do you suffer persecution in the cause of right and keep doing right? How do you trust God when you're on a cross like Jesus? These are the kind of big questions. And I think that's why it's put here. To remain poor in spirit on the cross is exactly what Jesus did, and that's what saves us. He shows us it can be done. Just a couple of texts. Righteousness. Not a terrible word, but it's so Latin-y, and it's all mixed up, actually. And now that I say that, it's not Latin at all, it's Anglo-Saxon, but it's so long. Right, you know what that means, and the E-O-U-S, righteous, means right wise. That's the word wise. Wise as to what is right. And they're both Anglo-Saxon words, as you realise. But when you make it a big word like righteousness, it just about loses all meaning. But it means wise as to what is right. And what is right means what God...